Crater City Paul. Before we do that, we should be aware of the fact that we have a distinguished European German scholar with us this morning, who has a very interesting background in his total training. He studied theology at the University of Erlangen and Heidelberg, and also at the Augustana Hochschule at Neu-Dettelsau. He is a member of the Ministerium of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Bavaria, that is South Germany. He spent a year in the States at Chicago on LWF fellowship, doing work at the former Chicago Theological Lutheran Theological Seminary in Maywood, and then spent 3 years as assistant to the director of the Department of Theology of the Lutheran World Federation in beautiful Geneva. In 1961 to 1967, he was assistant professor of New Testament and worked very closely with Dr. Leonard Gottfold, one of the distinguished professors of New Testament of the past, and Dr. Roloff also edited Dr. Gottfold's Theology of the New Testament. From 67 to 73, he served as associate professor of New Testament at the University of Hamburg, and since that time serves on the theological faculty of the University at Erlangen. I asked Dr. Roloff last night, how many students do you have in your faculty or the Department of Theology? And he said somewhere around 650, which is somewhere around the size which we are. I thought that was a very interesting number of people involved in the Department of Theology at Erlangen. The total enrollment there is somewhere around 16,000, although the figures will be more firm when they begin their winter term in the early part of November. Dr. Roloff has also been active in writing. Among the various other things that he has done, in addition to editing Dr. Gottfold's Theology of the New Testament, he has been the co-editor of the New Calver Predigthilfen. And if you've ever had Dr. Moldering in class, I'm sure that you have heard about this very helpful series, which is being coming out in a new series to make possible comments on the new pericopes which are being used in Germany. Some of you who handle the German will be happy to know that Dr. Roloff has finished a new commentary on Acts in the Das Neue Testament Deutsch, which takes the place of the one done by Dr. Stalin some years ago. And he will be working on a more popular commentary on Revelation, and then has taken upon himself a rather great task to prepare a new commentary in the Meyer series on the Gospel according to St. Matthew. He suggested last night that this might be a 10-year project, and I think if you look at the mass material which goes into this kind of a commentary on this subject matter, 10 years will undoubtedly fly by very quickly. So it is with distinct pleasure that we introduce to you Dr. Roloff, who will speak to us on a portrait of St. Paul.
Thank you so much for this kind welcome. My topic is Luke's portrait of St. Paul, its historical assumptions and its theological purpose. The depiction of Paul's working and ways which Luke provides us in his book of Acts is a singular phenomenon within the New Testament. Besides the gospel accounts of Jesus' message, work, and death, it is the only extensive historical account from the early Christian period. As such, it has had invaluable significance for the church from the second century on. Thanks to it, we are able, at least in rough outline, to reconstruct the historical context of Paul's letters and to localize them within his main period of activity. As is well known, A decisive reason for the Acts canonization in the early church was because it does provide a supplementary background information on Paul. This significance has not changed essentially to this day. For contemporary scholarship as well, the Acts, with its depiction of Paul, is an indispensable source for reconstructing the history of early Christianity. Indeed, besides Paul's letters, the only source we have. That is not altered by the fact that scholars have been necessitated to read it critically. What puzzles us so repeatedly in our investigation is certainly not the fact in itself that Luke's depiction of Paul is not able to satisfy the demands of modern historiography. It is far more the fact that it is riddled with strange inconsistencies. Thus, on the one hand, Luke gives astoundingly exact historical information regarding the course of Paul's missionary activity following the Apostolic Council, which is essentially corroborated by Paul's letters. However, on the other hand, at important points in Paul's biography, their creep into the presentation, as again a comparison with Paul's letters demonstrates, a blatant error. One need but recall the second visit to Jerusalem in Acts chapter 11, which is quite incompatible with Galatians 1 and 2. A further inconsistency involves Luke's picture of Paul as a whole. On the one hand, Luke allows Paul to become the major hero of his book. From that remarkable scene in chapter 7, literally calculated so precisely for effect, where he introduces Paul as the apparent superintendent of the stoning of Stephen, he accompanies him almost uninterruptedly upon all the stages of his journey, so that there arises at least the impression of a biographical intent. However, in chapter 28, he lets the curtain drop before the decision about Paul's fruits of faith is delivered. The conclusion of his trial, and thereby the last chapter of his biography, remain in the dark. Also incompatible are the findings regarding Luke's personal proximity to Paul. On the one hand, he leaves no doubt as to his admiration for the apostle to the Gentiles. He sketches, especially in the latter chapters, a picture of him which for graphicness and magnetic power far exceeds that of Peter, a clear witness for his Paulinism. On the other hand, however, it turns out that in decisive issues he stands somewhat distant from this Paul to whom he accords such admiration, such as when he lets his theology sound forth only abbreviated, in only abbreviated, cliched expressions, or when he withholds from him that very title which we know was constitutive for Paul's self-understanding, namely that of an apostle of Jesus Christ. Based on these and similar observations, it has become very unlikely that this depiction of Paul should have originated from the personal reminiscences of a man in immediate proximity to Paul. From the point of view of a biographer personally acquainted with his subject. However, this is certainly a point still open to debate, and I wouldn't make my major point on it. However, what should not be debated any longer is that this book, from its layout, is not intended as a biography at all. Just as little for that matter as the depiction of Jesus in the Gospels is. Moreover, Luke is chronologically separated from Paul by about one generation. What was then the intention behind his depiction of Paul? And how is it to be explained that there in such strange fashion distance and proximity are blended? These questions have always busied exegetes, above all within the context of intensive redaction critical research on this work. The prophet's solutions encompass a wide spectrum. I have just to mention here shortly the so-called tendence criticism of Ferdinand Christian Bauer and his pupils back in the 19th century. They propagated a solution which repeatedly proves to be suggestive right up to the present and which is very influential in contemporary German scholarship. According to Bauer and his followers, Luke's depiction of Paul would be interpreted as the product of an intra-church apology. Luke, so they claim, has consciously corrected the historical picture of the apostle to the Gentiles as it was reflected in his letters and as it otherwise lived on in the concrete memories of the Pauline congregation. In order to make Paul acceptable to certain church factions and to take the wind out of the sails of any anti-Paulinism. In this manner, the simultaneity of proximity and distance, of correct historical reminiscences and blatantly false information would in fact find an illuminating explanation. Most recently, it was Günter Klein, one of the students of Bultmann, who, remaining within the lines of this proposed solution, suspected Luke's pen to have been guided by his intent to wrest Paul from the Gnostic propaganda and to assimilate him into an orthodox early Catholic theology. He realized, according to Klein, this intention in that he, clearly contrary to his better knowledge, stripped Paul of the apostolate and robbed him of all theological originality. The Lucan Paul is accordingly a domesticated Paul, consciously portrayed as a subordinate member of an ecclesiastical hierarchy which proceeds from the 12 apostles in an apostolic succession. This thesis may be stimulating. Nevertheless, in my mind, it has not been able to stand up to critical questioning. There is quite convincing evidence that there can be no talk of a subordination of Paul to the 12. And moreover, in Acts, Paul stands fully authorized besides the 12 apostolic witnesses as the 13th witness and brings their joint commission to its historical consummation. This is another question which was frequently raised in recent research. Or might Luke have had in mind, with his depiction of Paul, an apology addressed to the outside, namely, a political defense of Christianity's inoffensiveness as regards the Roman Empire and its officials. This trail, likewise pursued already in the 19th century, was followed recently by the influential commentary of Ernst Haenchen in the Meyer series, and I think it's also been translated into English in the Seminar series. What seems in the first place to speak for the validity of this view is the fact that Luke narrates the imprisoned Paul's journey at such great length, and that especially in those scenes in which Paul is confronted by official representatives of the might of Rome. Still weightier than this formal consideration appears the internal argument. It is well known that Luke is interested, on the one hand, to demonstrate through Paul's mouth over and over the direct continuity between Christianity and Judaism, but on the other hand, to let the political harmlessness of precisely this Christianity be attested by the Romans involved. Haenchen sees the aim of Luke's depiction of Paul to be to propagate the inclusion of Christians within the privileges of licensed religion, religio licita, which were extended to Judaism and thereby within the guarantee of religious freedom in the Roman Empire. When the last sentence of the book Paul's unhindered activity in the capital, Rome, is reported, there is precisely a programmatic petition. Doubtlessly, something right has been grasped here. That Luke propagandizes for a rapprochement between Christians and the Roman Empire, and indeed from both sides, may be sufficiently evident. But does the point of his presentation of Paul actually lie here? If it were so, the end of the book at least would impair the persuasive power of Luke's argument at a decisive point. Luke owes or must owe the reader the decisive proof for the inoffensiveness of the Christian cause, which only Paul's acquittal in his trial would have supplied. But in any case, one must admit that the Acts could have been written by no means for a readership outside the church, with the aim of thereby enlisting sympathy for the Christian cause. Throughout, it proves to be a book intended for church use, which would enable Christians to understand better the foundations of their faith. Within this, at first only very broadly definable panorama, the presentation of Paul must also find its place. Several newer works, which I cannot mention here due to shortness of time, have attempted to seek and more exactly delineate that place precisely here. And in these works, fortunately, there is emerging in many respects an encouraging consensus. Thus, they see the starting point of Luke's depiction of Paul in the commission of the resurrected one in chapter 1, verse 8. You shall be my witnesses in Jerusalem, and all of Judea, and Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. So much appears to be clear. Luke wishes to show his community how this assignment has been brought to fulfillment through Paul's activity. He portrays him as the last and decisive witness of the church's beginning faith, through describing his way from Jerusalem to Rome. Admittedly, the opinions regarding how Luke understands and integrates this witness function of Paul's still differ widely. However, on the whole, in the present state of the debate, a certain clarification and consolidation is unmistakable. Certain tentative solutions have proven to be relevant and constructive, while others have had to retreat into the background. Nevertheless, now as before, there remains a plethora of disparate aspects whose ranking and weighing are by no means cleared up. Is it still possible to make any progress here? Certainly, the Lucan depiction of Paul is an unusually multi-layered phenomenon, and therefore, it is to be reckoned that every approach can catch sight of only a part of the interwoven relationships and associations. It may be, too, that each observer's view, conditioned as it is by his specific methodological point of departure and the direction of his inquiry, is able to encompass only a snippet of the whole picture. However, this should be no grounds for resignation, but much more an impetus to refine the methodological instruments so that they allow us to distinguish the basic driving elements of this picture from the countless other components present here, there. And it appears to me necessary, before all else, that we distinguish two questions more clearly than previously done. The first, the question about the historical presuppositions of Luke's picture of Paul. The second, the question about his own theological purpose. The first question involves the limitations imposed by the given framework within which Luke's literary struggle with the figure of Paul took place. Here belongs the traditions which stood at his disposal. What comprised them? What picture of Paul was already given? Here belongs further the concrete historical situation of the Lucan community as well as its theological background. It is very important whether and in what sense the memory of Paul already possessed relevance for this community. Not everything that Luke says about Paul may be charged to the account of his own literary designs. Given there are not only concrete elements of the tradition, but also definite aspects and perspectives. And it is to be reckoned that he often unreflectingly creates out of this given. Only against this background does what he says about Paul of his own literary and theological initiative gain its profile. A distinction between both questions is necessary as an heuristical principle, as little as they allow themselves to be severed. We must move to some extent within a hermeneutical circle they have set. The first question of the historical presuppositions, is first, but not exclusively, a question of the shape and extent of the tradition which Luke utilized. This has to be stated over against scholars who stand in danger of viewing Luke as a freely inventive author. And this danger is quite often to be observed, specifically in the German theological scene. The basis of tradition may not be very broad, but it is unavoidably present. It encompasses first a series of reports about the stations and progress of the apostles' missionary activity, supplemented by the so-called itinerary, those scanty V-form enumerations of each leg of the journey appearing in chapters 16, 20, 21, and perhaps also in chapter 27. That a part of these reports originated from an Antiochian collection recording prominent events in the congregation's early history appears to me now as before to be the most reasonable conjecture. Secondly, Luke employs a series of personal traditions which involves Paul's background and early history. Thus he knows of his birth in Tarsus, of his Roman citizenship, of his Pharisaic upbringing in Jerusalem, as well as Paul's other personal ties in the Holy City. But especially he knows of his activity as a persecutor of Christians, of his miraculous conversion outside Damascus, and of his flight from that city. That on the one hand, these personal traditions remain thoroughly fragmentary and do not crystallize into real biography of Paul is as clear as the fact, on the other hand, that they essentially approach what Paul says about himself in a polemical context in Galatians and 2 Corinthians, without there being evident any direct dependence upon the Pauline statement. What is significant here for us is the ascertainment that this polemical context had been long since forgotten by Luke's time, at least in the circles in which these traditions originated. This can be substantiated most clearly in the conversion story of Acts 9 verses 1 to 22. The form in which Luke found and used this tradition, it has obviously nothing more to do with the question of Paul's self-understanding and mission, but rather had become an edifying paradigm of the power of Jesus Christ, which is able to transform even opponents. Finally, there belongs to the material which Luke reworked a group of pronounced personal stories on Paul. Yet the stock of them may have been, and this is likewise significant, far more limited than that of the stories on Peter at Luke's disposal. And there is a significant difference in regard to the contents of the personal stories dealing with Paul and those dealing with Peter. While Peter appears working as a charismatic miracle worker, Paul is portrayed as a mightily working missionary and preacher. The most impressive examples for this are the defeat of the magician Elymas in Cyprus in chapter 13, the report of Paul's triumph over the heathen wizards in Ephesus chapter 19, as well as the raising of young Eutychus by his powerful word, at evening worship in Troas in chapter 20. Yet in utter distinction to Peter in the stories devoted to him, these stories, Paul is portrayed primarily not as a charismatic miracle worker, but as a mightily working missionary and preacher. By no means this can be only a coincidence. There are a series of signs indicating that Paul remained in the memory of Luke's church primarily as a great preacher and missionary to the Gentiles, while his inner church significance as mediator and defender of normative doctrine as well as the controversies over him largely receded. Luke reveals by the way he handles the Paul tradition that he does not know any more too much about Paul's ever having been controversial in the church. He confines himself to touching up the faded picture of the great preacher and missionary to the Gentiles, yet he mixes in it no new colors. It is symptomatic that, with one single exception, which we'll still have to discuss, he leaves him to speak exclusively to outsiders, to Jews and Gentiles, and not to Christians. He places missionary sermons in his mouth, which perhaps reproduce what may have been the fundamental Gentile missionary proclamation of Pauline Christianity, such as the Lystra speech in chapter 14 and the speech of the Areopagus in chapter 17. Of course, here and there, some genuine Pauline chords have been blended in. Above all, when Paul speaks in Pisidian Antioch about the possibility of justification through the law of Moses and about the justification of those who believe in Jesus, chapter 13, verse 38. However, nowhere does Luke leave any clue that he is aware of the controversial significance of this message, the conflict between Jewish and Gentile Christians. According to Luke's description, Paul does not need to fight at all at the Apostolic Council on behalf of a law-free Gentile mission. He and Barnabas, as Antiochian delegates, by their mere presence paved the way for the recognition, already latent within the men of the early church, Peter and James, that the whole law need not be imposed upon the Gentiles. Everything indicates that Luke by no means erased controversies familiar to him, knowingly harmonizing, but that for him and his congregation, these controversies were already a thing of the distant past. Pointing in the same direction is the known fact that in the Antiochian pieces of tradition, chapters 14, 4 and 14, he leaves the designation of Paul and Barnabas as apostles standing, even though he otherwise reserved the title of apostle for the circle of the 12. Were it Luke himself who, on current polemical grounds, strips Paul of the title of apostle, this negligence would be downright unexplainable. But evidently, this confining of the apostle to the 12 belongs already to the tradition of his church. That here might have lain a point of contention once, of that it seems he was no longer conscious. In general, one can say that Luke's church stands on the base of a Gentile Christianity whose justification is no longer contested. Freedom from the law is taken for granted without any further reflection. The conflicts with the Jewish Christians, if they ever did shake this church seriously, have long since become a part of history, surmounted and no longer understood in its inner problematic. It constitutes no contradiction when one establishes that this church pedigree is clearly not pure Gentile, but that it is still conscious of a now defunct Jewish heritage. It is striking how strongly Luke stresses Paul's Jewish past and the drama of the course of his life. But it involves neither current anti-Jewish or anti-Judaistic polemics, nor an apology which would defend Paul's image against aspersions and accusations, so there remains but one explanation for this striking fact. Paul has become an identification figure for Luke's church, by means of which it comprehendingly reworks the completed turn in its own history. However, for this church, He is not only a theological authority figure to whom one appeals for defining and delineating one's own theological position in contemporary conflicts. Thereby, the question about the Paulinism of the Lucan Church has been broached. How much has it been affected by any movements attempting to master the theological and ecclesiastical problems of its day, that is, the close of the first century, by means of updating and freshly interpreting Paul's teaching? There have been repeated attempts to draw the Lucan work into proximity to the Deutero-Pauline literature. And in fact, it does not lack points of contact with the pastoral letters and Ephesians, above all in regard to the here unmistakable interest in the issues of church order and office, but also in the received apostolic tradition. But this proximity should by no means be overestimated. The pastoral letters are by Jean Paul's farewell speeches in which he binds the church to a theological legacy and subordinates it to the order he has authorized. In contrast, the only thematically comparable passage in Acts is Paul's farewell speech to the Ephesian elders in Miletus chapter 20. This speech has a prominent position within the whole of Acts, not only because it is the only speech by the Lucan Paul before a Christian congregation. In addition, it is the only passage which expressly treats the problem of the transition from the second to the third generation. It distinguishes itself significantly from the pastoral epistles in the way in which it brings Paul's authority into play for explaining the continuity of the church. The pastorals contemporize Paul as a doctrinal authority figure. He is the apostle who mediated sound doctrine to the church, that body of doctrine from which it may not deviate in the future. The problem of continuity is here resolved through commitment to the apostle's teaching by remaining within the tradition derived from him. Now, this is completely different in the speech in Miletus. Paul here looks back upon his work. He underscores the faithfulness and sincerity of his service. He refers also to having proclaimed to the church the whole unabridged message of salvation, and he warns too, in keeping with the character of such speeches, against the influx of false teaching. Doubtless, this speech is a reflection of the problem of church continuity as experienced by the Lucan community in the transition from the second to the third generation. But Luke makes no attempt, in distinction to other groups, to overcome this problem through commitment to the normative Pauline doctrine. Instead, he has Paul say, "But now I commend you to the Lord and to the word of his grace," chapter 20, verse 32. What remains to the elders and the church they represent is first of all the historically powerful word of God, which will lead them in the same way it has led Paul. There remains to them, too, the recollection of Paul's service, the unconditional submission to the word manifested in him, which was exemplary and normative. However, completely missing is the church's commitment to a definite form of Pauline doctrine. From all this must be inferred, Luke is in a church for which the specifically Pauline teaching tradition does not play a prominent role in solving the problem of continuity. There is neither a full-fledged Paulinism, nor is Paul's teaching the object of controversy. Do the clues now allow a more concrete geographical localization of this church? We saw Luke is an exponent of a Gentile Christian church with a Jewish heritage, in which the memory of Paul as a missionary and church founder lives on, but for which the problem of Pauline teaching lay outside the horizon. It is difficult to imagine this church within the immediate Pauline mission field of Asia Minor and the Aegean. More than ever, a localization in Antioch is out of the question. All the mentioned clues point, though, to Rome, as many scholars have correctly seen already. Should one pursue this track, not only does one stumble upon a series of hints within the work which support it, but moreover, it appears that the background and history of the Roman congregation have decisively influenced the Lucan depiction of Paul at least one point, namely at its conclusion in chapter 28. Luke knows that Paul was killed in Rome. In my opinion, that emerged from chapter 20, verse 38, with sufficient clarity. And he furthermore agrees with the Roman tradition on Paul's martyrdom in 1 Clement chapter 5. Further, it is clear that Luke shapes Paul's journey to Rome in chapters 21 to 27 as a constant crescendo, which theological intent guided him will still have to be handled. For the time being, it is enough to establish that the arrival in Rome is the aim and culmination of the Lucan portrait of Paul, even if it means arrival at the place of martyrdom. The fact that Luke himself nevertheless reports nothing about the martyrdom has always distressed interpreters. However, at least, as strange may be another fact, Luke omits almost on purpose the Roman congregation in describing Paul's arrival in Rome. The comment now in 1 Clement 5, verse 2 could furnish a good explanation for that, insofar as one is prepared to take it literally, against which in my opinion no sufficient reason exists. There, Peter and Paul met their death in Rome, says, because of jealousy and envy. And that certainly means that internal controversies and splintering in the congregation was reckoned among the indirect causes for their death. Should Philippians have originated during Paul's Roman imprisonment, then his bitter remarks about the hostility directed against him by the Christians there yield a surprising commentary. The behavior of some is characterized by envy and strife, so Philippians 1, verse 15. Clearly, the Roman congregation did not endorse Paul unanimously. It is not unthinkable that these intrigues, set by group rivalries, snared the responsibility for the grave turn finally taken by Paul's trial. This would explain why Luke treats neither Paul's relationship to the Roman congregation nor the circumstances of his death. He knew of Paul's trial and its background from local traditions in the Roman Church, but he kept it secret, be it not to tear open old wounds afresh in this, his congregation, or be it so as not to detract right at the end from his programmatically designed picture of a conflict-free ecclesiastical harmony. But now, what is the theological purpose of the portrait of Paul which Luke develops from the historical given just now sketched? In answering this second question, it is advisable to proceed not from single passages, whose very selection and evaluation always implies the interpreter's bias, but from formal observations. Luke is accustomed to signaling his intentions clearly by deploying his compositional skills. Setting was first, marking turning points with retrospectives and prospectives. Secondly, constructing overarching narratives, and third, redundancy, that is, accenting through repetition. It is striking that in the last third of the book, chapters 19 to 28, the frequency of these methods escalates. You must conclude, therefore, that here lies the self-determined focal point of his depiction of Paul, and thereby the focal point of the entire book. The theme of this section is Paul's journey from Jerusalem to Rome. In 19, verse 21 is the turning point, and at that time the solemn introduction to this part. Paul manifests his resolve given him by the Holy Spirit himself. He wishes to journey to Jerusalem, and afterwards he must see Rome. There begins an overarching narrative which extends unbroken to the last verse of the last chapter. Paul comes, accompanied by signs of the approaching calamity, to Jerusalem. First, it appears his fate is utterly sealed. The trap set for him by his Jewish opponents closes. He seems to be abandoned to Judaism's dammed-up hatred. Yet, now is heralded the first glimmer of hope, as the Roman world, personified in the tribune Claudius Lysias, intervenes. Its representatives encounter Paul in well-meaning neutrality. prepared to give in his rights as a Roman citizen, but without betraying any positive sympathy for the cause he represents. Subsequently, the narrative suspense is nursed by the question, can Paul succeed with the help of the Romans, his unwitting protectors, in escaping from the sphere of calamity Jerusalem symbolizes, and in reaching his God-ordained goal, Rome? And of course, the positive Rome-oriented movement is repeatedly endangered by retarding motives in which the sphere of calamity, mostly represented by Jerusalem and the Jews, seeks to seize Paul. Already the first step to safety, the transfer to the Roman sphere of control in Caesarea, has to be carried out in the face of all kinds of opposition and danger. And once completed, it appears still again endangered by the Sanhedrin's petition to Felix to extradite Paul to Jerusalem for trial. That is repeated after Festus assumes office as procurator. Paul can escape the danger only by appealing to the emperor, to which he is entitled as a Roman citizen. Thereby, the way to Rome seems irrevocably open. The Roman authorities themselves will bring him there as prisoner. Yet, shortly before reaching the goal, new dangers intervene but once more: tempest, shipwreck, and even deadly snakebite.